Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The instability in the Ukraine has the world watching and waiting. Following Crimea's return to the Russian fold, separatists are demanding the same for other parts, if not all, of Ukraine. The West-leaning government in Kiev says the separatists are directed by Russia. Russian troops are near the border. NATO is watching closely. The United States and European Union support the government in Kiev, but have so far been unable to influence the outcome. Sanctions seem the only available tool. I'm Don Marsh. Most of us can't pretend to fully understand the complexities of the situation, but we're talking today with two women who can help. With me in studio is Monica Eppinger, assistant professor at St. Louis University School of Law. She has spent time in Ukraine on two occasions, once as a Foreign Service officer and once as an academic. I spoke yesterday with Ukrainian-born Olga Chish, a postdoctoral research associate in the Political Science Department at Washington University. She still has family in Ukraine. We'll talk to her in a few moments, but first, Monica Eppinger. Monica, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
It is such a fluid situation. What's your take in general on what's going on right now?
There are two interlocking set of crises. One is an internal crisis that was started as a political crisis and has become an economic crisis. And the second is an external crisis that involves President Putin and his designs on parts of Russia or parts of Ukraine.
No one has really quite figured out exactly what President Putin has in mind.
That's as far as I know. Yes, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, it's hard to try to establish what he may be thinking. A lot of people are certainly trying to figure that out.
That's right.
Is Ukraine a divided nation?
It's divided in the same way that the United States or many other countries are divided, but not along the ways that we hear stereotyped in the press. So what I hear over and over in the U.S. press is that it's divided between a Russian-speaking, Russian-leaning East and a Ukrainian-speaking, or Europe-leaning West. And that is not the division that matters. So polls show that an extremely small minority, even in eastern Ukraine, would favor any kind of union with Russia, less than 9%. So this so-called Russian-leaning East doesn't really lean to Russia. Most people in Ukraine speak Ukrainian and Russian. It's a bilingual country.
The language issue is one that the Russians seem to be pointing at specifically because they want to protect, or whatever word they're using at the time, the Russian-speaking people. You say this is kind of a bogus issue then.
It is a bogus issue. It's bogus, but it can be made into a hot-button issue depending on how the central government in Kiev treats the issue. So most people in Ukraine are bilingual, and polite practice in Ukraine is whatever language someone speaks to you first in, you answer in that language. So if someone speaks to me on the street in Ukrainian, I answer in Ukrainian. If they speak to me in Russian, I answer in Russian. And how it can be turned into a hot button issue is if the central government in Kiev doesn't allow for that kind of flexibility in state institutions. So you can imagine if your preferred language is Russian, if you're most comfortable in Russian and you show up for a court date, you want the proceedings to be in Russian. You want the witnesses to be interviewed in Russian, or you want to send your kids to a Russian language school. And the Ukrainian government has since independence in 1991, been pretty flexible as a matter of policy. But there have been moments where that has gotten harder, and that has not served the interests of the country.
Well, what can we make of the government in Kiev now? It's really kind of an interim government, if you will. Presidential elections are scheduled for May.
That's right. That's right. Presidential elections are scheduled for May 25th. And the government in Kiev right now is trying to hold it together until the presidential elections. They were handed a bankrupted country on the verge of default. When they came to power on February 23rd, the country saw immediately its currency devalue by something like 25%. They're trying to stave off economic panic, and they're trying to keep the country. In the middle of all of this, then Putin has invaded and taken over the third of their southern coast and is starting on designs on the eastern section of the country. So they're trying to stave off an invasion while they're trying to hold it together until elections.
Does invasion in your mind seem a real possibility?
I think invasion is already occurring. So there are plainclothes invaders that are wearing matching camouflage uniforms with no insignia, which is exactly how the invasion of Crimea started. On March 1st and 2nd, there was a plainclothes invasion of Crimea, followed by a referendum, so-called sham referendum, 2 weeks later. And on April 12th, that's what we saw starting in eastern Ukraine, plainclothes invasion.
And these plainclothes invaders are people who speak with an accent, we understand, here from our press reports, and can't find their way around town.
Right. In the big towns, they can't find their way around town. They don't know the major landmarks. It would be like somebody pretending to be from St. Louis, and you ask them where's the arch, and they don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of a tip-off.
Right.
I think most people would agree. NATO made an announcement this morning indicating that it's become quite restless with all that's going on. What do you make of NATO's position right now?
NATO is very clear. NATO has been very clear. NATO is a mutual defense treaty, and under Article 5 of the NATO treaty, an attack on any member state of NATO is considered an attack on all of them, and they all are obligated by their treaty obligations to defend. Ukraine is not a member of NATO. NATO will not be defending Ukraine militarily. However, there are NATO members bordering Ukraine, including Baltic countries, including Poland, and that's where NATO is stepping up its presence. Romania, Bulgaria, also neighbors of Ukraine.
The most frightening scenario, as I understand it, would be if any kind of fighting in Ukraine spilled over into some place like Poland, for instance, with whom we do have, which is part of NATO, and we would be obligated, I assume, to go in and help defend Poland if, in fact, it were threatened somehow.
That's all true. That would be the most frightening scenario for us. That would not be the most frightening scenario for Ukrainians, because for Ukrainians, the most frightening scenario is that they have to hold off the Russian army by themselves.
Well, I wonder how, and of course we don't know, how President Putin and his people would be thinking about NATO's position right now.
President Putin gave a speech on March 18th. You can actually read it in English on the Kremlin.gov website.
And I haven't been there recently, I must confess.
So he was very, very clear. It would surprise me greatly if Putin or his advisors had any wish for a military encounter with NATO. What they want is a buffer state between Russia and NATO, which now includes Poland, which is right on the other side of Ukraine, or at least a buffer region. If they absorb Ukraine, then Ukraine would be their buffer region. And they also want to push back. They have been telling their own public, Putin and his advisors have been telling the Russian population, that NATO has encircled us. And that's a bit of malarkey, because NATO only touches Russia's border at a very small few hundred miles out of an 11 time zone country. Mm-hmm. But so they want to push back for their own popular reasons.
And again, you've indicated that you're not an expert on President Putin, but we have been reading and hearing a lot that what he is up to is trying to really deflect attention at home to some of the problems that Russia has right now by all the saber-rattling in Ukraine.
That would be the pattern that he's followed in the past. In 2008, when they had an economic meltdown in Russia, he invaded part of Georgia and still occupies a northern part of Georgia called South Ossetia. That would be consistent with what he's done. When there's economic problems at home, he starts to work the smoke and mirrors machine.
I wonder if there is any potential for civil war, what we would call a civil war in Ukraine now between the separatists and those loyal to Kiev.
Well, certainly there are... anything is possible. I wouldn't rule it out. Excuse me. But Ukrainians universally have expressed, and this is irregardless of political leaning or loyalty, have expressed their first priority is no bloodshed, especially with each other, but even including against Russians or anyone else. And so that was the policy that they followed in Crimea. Ukrainian military bases were surrounded during the invasion, and they were shot at, and they didn't shoot back. And that's been the path that they've been trying to follow in eastern Ukraine as well. And the civilian population feels the same way. Ukraine was occupied for all of World War II. And the front, they were occupied by the Nazis and the Soviets. The front changed sides 6 or 7 times in some parts of Ukraine. Most people lost three or four grandparents during the war. So they have a very – and they commemorate the war every year. So no one wants bloodshed.
But if there were – if this were to happen, wouldn't this serve Putin's interests because it would give him an excuse to – if he needs one, to move in?
Well, if there were a, what looked like a civil war in Ukraine, the it would be actually part of a Russian invasion because the weapons would be coming from Russia and the advisors would be coming from Russia. And already there are Russian special forces that seem to be operating in eastern Ukraine. So what would look like a civil war would actually be a Russian invasion with some resistance against it.
You indicated as you came into the studio today that you have been in contact with some of your friends in Ukraine. What are they telling you?
It depends on the part of the country that they live in. People in the far eastern part of Ukraine wake up every morning for the last 6 weeks wondering if they are going to hear Russian boots outside their door. And there are 40,000 Russian troops in the city of Luhansk. It's about 20 miles from the Russian border. And right across that border, there are 40,000 Russian troops that have been massed that aren't usually there. So people in that part of the country are really living in fear. People in Donetsk Oblast, which is where these small towns have had their city buildings taken over in the, over the last 5 days, they say that if you don't go near the city administration building, life actually, or you don't try to pass a checkpoint in or out of town, life actually feels kind of normal. And then if you get to Kiev, everyone is absorbed with the economic crisis that the country is in as much as the war crisis. But people are preoccupied.
I want to back up just a second because you said that what the people don't want is bloodshed. And of course,
right.
That's understandable. But there has been bloodshed. No one's been killed that we know of. But there have been some firefights in which a number of people have been wounded.
Right. So actually, one Ukrainian officer was killed, it seems, this morning. The Ministry of Defense sent out a notification that one Ukrainian officer was killed in this action to retake an airfield yesterday. And there, two other Ukrainian military personnel were beaten and kidnapped this morning and have disappeared. And I'd be surprised if we find them in good shape if they're alive at all. So in eastern Ukraine, at least one, maybe three deaths and possibly more. In Crimea, three or four deaths that I know of. And then in Kiev, during the civil strife during the winter, in trying to depose this corrupt regime that was a puppet of Putin, something like 103 Ukrainians died and 18 policemen. So there has been bloodshed, but people have been trying to avoid it.
But clearly the situation is ratcheted up at least a little bit every day and has been since the people were fired on in the square.
That's right.
Right. We're talking with Monica Eppinger from St. Louis University. She is an expert on the situation in Ukraine. Monica, I'm going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll talk with a young lady who is from Ukraine. She is at Washington University. She was born there. She'll return in just a few weeks to visit her family. The timing is not terrific for a family get-together, I would say, but she says she's going to go back. We'll meet her in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on the situation in the Ukraine in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Defying a potential veto, Missouri House members were poised to give final approval today to an income tax cut for individuals and some businesses. If given final approval, the bill could reduce state revenues by hundreds of millions of dollars annually when fully phased in. University of Missouri President Tim Wolf has indicated that he will announce a new step today in the UM system's process to improve reporting and preventing sexual assault. The issue stems from an investigation into the events surrounding the death of former Mizzou swimmer Sasha Minyakuri. And the City of St. Louis Board of Estimate and Apportionment is considering a request today by developer Paul McKee for an extension to pay a nearly $60,000 bill for legal services. Some residents from the 3rd and 5th wards are opposed and are bringing the message, quote, "I pay my bills on time, so should Paul McKee." Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. We are talking today about the volatile situation in the Ukraine. With me in studio is Monica Eppinger, assistant professor at St. Louis University School of Law. She spent time in Ukraine on two occasions, once as a Foreign Service officer, once as an academic. Yesterday, I sat down with Olga Cheech, who was born in Odessa, Ukraine, and came here 12 years ago. She is a postdoctoral research associate in the political science department at Washington University. She still has family in the Ukraine and plans to return to visit soon. I asked her what her concerns are as she watches the situation in her homeland unfold.
Well, there are two types of concerns. On the personal level, my concerns are that I have to go back to my country in a couple weeks here to visit my family, and I don't know how safe it is to be there, especially since I come from a region in southern Ukraine, which is a Russian, traditionally region where people speak Russian as their primary language. And also, this is, of course, the region that Russia seems to have identified for expanding its aggression. So on a personal level, of course, I'm concerned for my family's safety as well as for my own safety. On a more general level, I'm very concerned for my country because what is happening in Ukraine is a threat to Ukraine's sovereignty and Ukraine's future.
Are you at all concerned about the international reaction to it? It doesn't seem like there's much anybody outside of that area can do.
I think it's very tricky, right? Because the area is traditionally within the Russian sphere of interest, which makes that European powers as well as the U.S. are very hesitant to intervene, at least militarily. So, yes, I'm concerned. Yes, I wish they could do more. But I also, of course, understand that it is not a simple situation.
Do you feel that that Russia has ultimate designs on the entire country?
Of course. Okay, so I don't really have good scientific evidence to back up my claim. So what I'm saying here is purely my opinion that is based on me following the news, so reading the newspapers, talking to people back home. So this is my personal opinion as opposed to my professional opinion. But yes, I think that Russia has as its end goal to take over the whole territory of Ukraine and maybe not even stop at Ukraine, but also perhaps annex other territories of the former Soviet Union. I think the ultimate goal of the current Russian administration is to reunite what used to be the Soviet Union in some kind of form.
You know, you come from an area in which Russian is the predominant language. Is that correct?
Yes.
But we've been hearing, and again, I'm not sure what we're hearing is absolutely true, but that people in Ukraine are bilingual and that there is no, that's not necessarily true that we speak of Russian language speakers, that that's the only language they speak.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So my generation and people that went to school after my generation are bilingual because somewhere in the 90s, there was a law that all Ukrainian schools have to be taught in the official state language, which was Ukrainian. So my generation went to school where we had all our classes taught in Ukrainian, except for, of course, Russian classes. So, yeah, I'm bilingual, and so are people who are younger than me.
So if President Putin is saying that he is going in there to help and to protect and to save Russian-speaking people, doesn't ring necessarily true.
Yes. I think what he means is those people who are older than me, so the generation that grew up in the Soviet Union and went to school in the Soviet Union. So my parents and their generation, or my grandparents even, for them, Russian definitely is their primary language of communication, especially if they live in the South or in the East. So I think when he talks about protecting ethnic Russians, he primarily is referring to those people. Now, do ethnic Russians need his protection? Is there a threat to ethnic Russians? I, as an ethnic Russian, I don't feel like there is a threat to me from at least not from the Ukrainian government. If I talk to a lot of my friends who also don't consider themselves to be under threat and in need of protection. So you can definitely dispute how much of a threat there is. And that, of course, there, of course, questions the motives of the Russian government.
Let's bring this back to a personal level now. You're in contact with your family and with friends in Ukraine?
Yes.
What are they telling you?
They're very concerned. So what they're telling me, there are two. So I have friends in Kyiv, which is a more pro-Ukrainian area of the country. So there are less concerns, at least on a personal level, about people in Kyiv. And then I have friends and family in Odessa. So my friends and family in Odessa are extremely scared, concerned, worried about the situation. Because what we see happening is that there so the Russian government claims that it is the ethnic Russians who are protesting and who are demanding that Russia intervenes. But what we actually see happening, at least in my native city of Odessa, is that it's not the Odessites who are protesting in the main squares of Odessa. It's these people who, I don't know where they come from, but I suspect that a lot of them are just Russians who are being sent into Ukraine, taking advantage of the loose border patrol and very, very loose immigration laws when it comes to, you know, Russians traveling to Ukraine. So what I think is happening is that there are a lot of these Putin-sent Russians from Russia who are there to provoke the situation and to stir up unrest in the eastern and southern cities.
There seems to be some evidence of that, in as much as many of these so-called separatists speak with accents and don't know their way around. I mean, they're supposed to be from that area, and yet they get lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is not to say that they have absolutely no support in the eastern and southern regions. I think it's important to acknowledge that there is some support. There are some parts of the population that do support the separatist movement. So it'd be unfair to say that it's just the Russian sent saboteurs there. But I think the support is being grossly overestimated by the Russian sources, the Russian media. I think it's not as high as Putin claims it is.
Tell me what your reaction to the vote in Crimea was.
I think that was very sad and a gross mockery of what it means to hold a free and fair election. The election was not free and fair in any way, really. The choices on the ballot were basically the same. The people were forced to go vote. I've heard a lot of reports of people being threatened so that they have to go show up to the election and vote. There were troops on the ground, which of course questions how free and fair the elections were. Journalists were denied access to the election location, so they couldn't provide adequate coverage of the elections. So I think the election was a huge violation of Ukrainian legitimacy, constitution, and also on the international level of what we mean by free and fair elections.
What do your parents say about that?
I think my parents would completely agree with my description of it.
Are they afraid?
Yes. They're afraid for, especially since my parents own property in the southern parts of the country. They're, of course, afraid for the security of their property. I mentioned there are all these Russian people being sent into Ukraine. So there is also concern about possible vandalism. And just general uncertainty of the situation.
Is there a fear, perhaps, of civil war ultimately coming of this?
I honestly don't think how else this is going to resolve, because I think on one hand, the Russian government is not going to stop. And on the other hand, I think at some point, Ukrainian government is going to start fighting back.
Well, they've already started that, mm-hmm. in a sense. Of course, this is a very fluid situation. It changes from hour to hour. But that is a concern that to those people you speak to there, a concern that they have. The civil war is the ultimate outcome of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so they have started fighting back a little bit, but those have been very meager efforts, right? What I'm saying is that I think they eventually will actually start fighting back, where there'll be bloodshed and arrests, and the situation is going to get much worse.
Why would you want to go back? I understand the desire to see your family, but going back now seems ill-advised.
I always go back during the summers, and I want to be with my family, and I want to see my friends. And this is, I guess this is the time when I'm able to visit my country. Mm-hmm. I don't know when else I'll be able to see my country.
You're going back regardless of what the situation is?
Well, of course, if there is massive violence all of a sudden, then maybe I'll change my arrival date. But otherwise, yes, I'm going back.
A lot of people would say, gee, it's probably not a real good idea to do that right now.
You know, I mentioned that there is unrest in Odessa, but I also mentioned that there are other parts of the country that seem practically untouched by what is happening. So my relatives in Kyiv are able, at least so far, have been able to go about their daily life as if nothing is happening. Mm-hmm. So the stores still sell things, right? They still go to their jobs. The life seems to be happening as if nothing is going on in the south.
One of the one of the tools, if I can use that word, that the West, the Euro Union, and the United States has sanctions. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts as to the effectiveness of sanctions on Mr. Putin.
I think the European Union, there's definitely ways to target economic sanctions in a way that would hurt and undermine Putin's power. Now, I think the European Union is very hesitant to impose sanctions. They've really been dragging their feet on escalating sanctions in the view of what is happening. So I think there are some obvious factors that are holding them back from imposing sanctions that actually would be effective.
And, of course, that seems to be the only tool that the West has.
It seems to be the only tool that the West is willing to use.
What would you like to see as a Ukrainian in the United States? What would you like to see?
I think it's not just me. I think the Ukrainian government is hoping for some kind of military support, not just economic support. It's obvious that the Ukrainian army cannot defeat the Russian army for very clear reasons. So while Ukraine can try fighting back, it's a fight that they're not going to win unless they have some kind of support from NATO, from the U.S., from the European Union.
That's a very dangerous, slippery slope.
That definitely is, but it's also a slippery slope when we allow Putin to take over parts of sovereign countries, right? So today he's taking over Crimea and maybe part of Ukraine. What if tomorrow he starts to annex, I don't know, other parts like the Baltic states?
Then it becomes much more slippery,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it? You're a political scientist.
Yeah.
This, I guess, is really quite a lesson for you in your chosen field, political science. What are you learning from this, and how are you viewing it here as a political scientist?
This definitely has been perhaps the most interesting period in my life in terms of my professional interests. There are several projects that have been inspired by what is happening in Ukraine. Last winter, some co-authors and I have collected some data. We interviewed people who were in the main square protesting, and there is some research that is going to come out of that.
Mm-hmm. Is there a diplomatic solution to this?
I wish there was, but I think for a diplomatic solution to happen, there have to be irrational actors that are willing to negotiate. And unfortunately, I don't think that the Russian government and the Russian president are very willing to negotiate.
Give me your impression. I think I have it already, but I'd like to hear you describe it, your impression of President Putin.
I think President Putin currently is in this maybe stage of his career where he is ready to work on his legacy. So what kind of president is he going to be, the way he is going to be portrayed in history books or textbooks that students read after he is gone? So I think this working on his legacy for him means that he needs to correct what he referred to as the biggest mistake of the modern history, so the breakup of the Soviet Union. And I think that what he's doing in Ukraine is a sign that he he feels like this is time to do, to start doing this.
To start doing this, by that you mean kind of reassembling the old Soviet bloc, is that it?
Yeah, that's what I think he's doing.
Do your parents feel that way? Do your friends feel that way?
Yeah, I think what happened in a way is that before the annexation of Crimea, Putin had much more support in Ukraine than after what is happening. So my parents, I would even go so far as to say that my friends and my family didn't necessarily like him, but were sympathetic to him, agreed with a lot of his policies, especially his economic policies, and maybe even saw benefits in Ukraine working with Russia. And then, of course, these aggressive moves in the Crimean and the east and south of Ukraine led to huge decrease in how much people like Putin, and a lot of resentment and other negative emotions and feelings towards Putin and Russia.
What would be so bad about once again becoming part of Russia?
I think the way Russia is now. So let me explain what I mean. So I think present-day Russia, while it's definitely stronger economically than present-day Ukraine, is also a much more repressive regime politically. So we know that people don't really have freedom of speech. There is no political opposition, right? You can't even go out and stand in the street with a poster without being arrested. So I think what is happening in Russia in terms of civil freedoms is horrific, and compared to that, Ukraine is a much more liberal environment. So, while economically Ukraine and even economically, actually, I don't think Russia is capable of supporting what is about 40 million people that will be added to Russia if Ukraine were to join Russia. So I think both economically and politically, in terms of civil liberties, it would not be a good option for Ukraine.
But of course, what Ukraine had prior till very recently, with the president who has just recently departed, was extremely corrupt, and it didn't seem to be a very democratic operation.
Yes, President Yanukovych, of course, was a very pro-Russian-oriented president who was very corrupt, that's correct. I don't think any more corrupt or any less corrupt than the government in Russia or the bureaucracy in Russia. So I think that reaffirms what I just said. I think Ukraine would not be any better off by joining Russia. I think if Ukrainian situation could be improved, that would be through strengthening the ties to the European Union and trying to follow the path of countries like Poland or Czech Republic or Slovakia.
Which is precisely what started this whole exercise, was the difference in thought between aligning with the West and aligning with Russia. Do you have any fears that things you say here today and things you have been saying could be a problem for your friends and parents back home?
Not yet. I think the situation is deteriorating, but I think at this point, Ukrainian citizens still have the freedom to express their opinions without persecution, which I don't know if I would be able to say the same if I were a Russian citizen.
The presidential election is going to be held in Ukraine in a couple of weeks. Is this a way out of the problem, do you think?
I think it's even a big question whether they will be able to hold the election. There have been a lot of attempts to prevent Ukraine from holding an election. If they were to be able to hold a successful election, I don't know if that would solve all the problems, but it would definitely help. I think Ukraine needs a strong president or a strong working government that would be able to react to Russian maneuvers in the east and respond to Russian aggression. The current government is either unwilling or unable to do that.
Your parents and friends aware that Soviet troops and Soviet armor is well positioned along the border?
Yes, and the recent takeover of several cities in the eastern Ukraine have given them an even better position, because now they have access to a major intersection of roads between the three eastern cities. They have access to, from what I could read in the newspapers, it seems like they have access to this old airfield that hasn't been used, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't have runways for Russia to possibly land its planes and bring in Russian troops that way into the country. So, and also there is considerable storage of arms and weapons in the area that they have been able to capture. So I think they are very quickly fortifying their position in eastern Ukraine, and this is very alarming.
Can any good come of all of this?
I think the positive, of course, is the hope that Ukraine, at least maybe part of Ukraine, would be able to become free and establish stronger ties to the European Union. Now, how large this part of Ukraine will be is a huge question, and it's very concerning.
There's one other area, and this may not be something for you to discuss, but I'll try it anyway. My understanding is the United States, in a treaty with Ukraine, with regard to the removal of nuclear weapons, agreed to preserve its territorial integrity. That creates a scenario that I think a lot of people in this country and elsewhere might see as a problem. How do you see it?
Do you mean in terms of what the U.S. is undermining, is going back on its promise to protect?
If it has promised to protect the territorial integrity of the Ukraine, how does it do that?
Well, I think what is currently happening can definitely in the way be interpreted as going back on the promise. I hope that this will change. I hope that they will try to at least maybe help with military equipment, if not with, you know, sending troops on the ground.
You're not suggesting troops on the ground, are you? Did you just say they should provide? I'm curious.
I did say that I don't think Ukraine can defeat the huge Russian army militarily. I don't think Ukraine can defeat Russia and without some help from the NATO or from the United States. So if U.S. and Europe decides to try to stop Russian expansion, then I think the only way to do that is to help militarily.
That's war.
Well, I know it's war, but the other side of this is not doing anything and possibly letting Russia take over Ukraine and then Moldova and then maybe the Baltic states. And so at what point do you start stopping them?
I don't know. That is a key question.
There needs to be some very credible signals to Russia that something like that would be unacceptable. And I don't see the U.S. and the European Union sending those signals.
You've been listening to Olga Cheech, a postdoctoral research associate at Political Science Department at Washington University. With me in studio is Monica Eppinger of St. Louis University. I'll take a break and Monica will come back and talk about what you've just heard. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on Ukraine. With me in studio is Monica Eppinger, an expert on that part of the world. She is from St. Louis University. Monica, what do you think about what you just heard?
I thought that Olga Cheech is an excellent representative of her country. I was touched by both her intellectual capacity of analyzing a really fluid situation and her personal concerns for her country and for her family and for her city. She comes from a heroic city that has done its part in the last few days to stop a takeover that like what has happened in the other parts of the country. So citizens interposed themselves in between a mob that would have taken over their government buildings.
Her last comments with regard to boots on the ground for NATO or European nations, the United States, I think a lot of people would find disturbing. I mean, she doesn't want war, but that would be war, wouldn't it?
I think that's a hypothetical that isn't going to happen. The United States has said clearly, our president has said that we are not sending troops. And NATO has said clearly that Ukraine has been a great ally but is not a member state. So the United States and NATO are not going to war in Ukraine. That doesn't mean war won't happen or isn't already happening, but they're on their own.
But as we indicated earlier in our discussion, things could spill over to other places that could create a very dangerous scenario.
That's true. And from what I've heard from President Putin and his circle, I see no indication that he wants to go to war with NATO.
But what about that promise we made to protect the territorial integrity of Ukraine in exchange for them getting rid of these nuclear weapons that they had so many of?
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, well, we did make the promise.
But we did,
indeed.
She
said, are we breaking the promise?
Ukraine's territorial integrity has been violated, was violated with this referendum and subsequent actions by the Russian Duma after March 16th, and is currently being violated in eastern Ukraine. The United States has an obligation. And lest we think that the stakes are only in Ukraine, think about all of the other countries that have security guarantees from the United States that are watching us very closely. If you were sitting in Israel, or if you were sitting in South Korea, or in Taiwan, or in Japan, or you name the country, you would be watching very closely.
Vladimir Putin has us over a barrel, doesn't he?
In the short term, it looks like there are no great military options for the United States. There are lots of other options. And Russia is a weak country. I think our president named it correctly. Russia is a regional power. They are not a world power.
But they're mocking us when we talk about sanctions. They're laughing at us. Medvedev has laughed out loud at us.
Yeah, they've laughed and they've lost $100 billion, twice the cost of their Olympics in the last 6 weeks. And the cost of Russian companies getting money to run their businesses has gone up catastrophically for them. So the European bond market, they are not laughing on the European bond market. And some members of the Russian government are putting on a brave face, but this is folly. This is a disaster for the Russian people and for the Russian economy and for the Russian government.
Well, their economy is a one-trick pony. I mean, it's all based on energy. And I understand Germany yesterday has decided that it is going to supply Ukraine with a fairly sizable amount of natural gas.
That's right. There's a German private company that's going to be supplying Ukraine with natural gas that will service approximately one-fifth of Ukraine's current energy needs.
And what impact is that likely to have on anything?
Well, the more diverse Ukraine's energy supplies, just as with the United States, the more latitude we have in our foreign policy, and there's a trickle-down effect for how we can conduct our lives at home.
There has been some suggestion, I believe it came from Kiev within the last day or two, that that the government there would welcome a United Nations presence there, a peacekeeping force of some sort. Does that sound like a realistic option to you?
Yes. The trick will be getting it through the United Nations, because if they need a UN Security Council approval, the Russian Federation has veto power as a permanent member of the Security Council. But the Ukrainian government they have contributed serious numbers of troops to UN peacekeeping operations since Ukrainian independence. They have provided, if not the majority outside of African conflicts of UN peacekeepers. So it would be great if the UN could reciprocate in Ukraine's time of need.
Is there a diplomatic option, do you think? And I'll just, before I ask you to answer that, it's my understanding that Russian representatives and representatives from the Ukraine are going to be meeting, I think, in Geneva or Brussels or someplace within the next day or two to talk about all of this. Is there a diplomatic way out?
You know, I have to admit, I'm old school enough that I feel like diplomacy is for relationships between countries about international affairs. And Russia has no place in Ukraine. This is a domestic matter. And I resist even talking about a so-called diplomatic solution short of the Russian Federation's stopping interfering in Ukraine.
Our head of the CIA apparently spent some time recently in Kiev, Mr. Brennan. That is interesting. Does it interest you as much as I'm sure it does many people?
I think it's interesting that he went, and I think that it's interesting that both sides let it be known that he went. because he could have gone without detection, of course, or at least without as quick detection. So I think that that was a signal to the Russian government that we're not leaving the Ukrainians out to dry and that we are cooperating with intelligence sharing. And it has been suggested by some of our senior diplomats that we'll be looking into providing equipment and supplies for the Ukrainian military. So there may be ways of supporting Ukraine's capacity without putting our boots on the ground.
Time is getting away. We've had a couple of calls. I'll bring in Jeff, who's been hanging on very patiently throughout this program. Jeff, go ahead with your question or comment, please, but please make it brief.
Okay, I'll try to. I'm trying to be objective. I have been trying to be objective about this whole crisis, and to that end, I'm curious to know, do the Russian-speaking people have any legitimate grievances? Specifically, is there any actual discrimination, and is there legitimacy to claims of Western agents operating in the Maidan Square protests? And then to that also, do I understand correctly that the most militant elements in those protests were the far-right groups, including the Svoboda Party, which I understand came to prominence as a result of Viktor Yushchenko's efforts to cultivate anti-nationalist sentiment, and that they had, I think, 10% of the vote in the last election? So my question there is, what presence do the ultra-nationalists have now in the current government? And to what extent do they represent the pro-fascist sentiments that the Russian-speaking people fear?
Great question, and there's a lot packed in there. So your first question was, do the peoples of eastern Ukraine have legitimate grievances? I would say the grievance of any citizen in a democracy is a legitimate grievance. It may or may not be founded on full information, but they have legitimate grievances. The grievances that they have are mostly not about discrimination. That's not a grievance that people raise. The grievance that people raise is about representation on the national level. And that's something that Ukraine is trying to work out with some recent constitutional reforms and with the presidential elections coming up. The last president of Ukraine was from this region, was from eastern Ukraine, and could be again. There's nothing stopping an eastern Ukrainian presidential candidate from running, and 10 million voters in eastern Ukraine out of 45 million people in the country means that they have a serious voting bloc. So there are legitimate grievances, but not of discrimination based on ethnicity or language per se. The right-wing elements, there's no truth that I've been able to ascertain to any claim of Western agents being involved in the Maidan protests this winter. And only in our wildest dreams would the United States government have that kind of capacity. We had no idea most of the time what was going on because these were unplanned and spontaneous demonstrations. So we didn't know in advance. We certainly weren't provoking things. As regards the right-wing element in Ukrainian politics, the right-wing in Ukrainian politics had only the largest amount of votes that they had ever gotten was about 2% of the votes in a national election until the recently deposed president, the guy that got run out of town on a rail, Viktor Yanukovych, when he jailed his opposition candidate after he won the presidency, he jailed the person who ran against him, Tymoshenko. And some of her voters in Western Ukraine, without other viable options, started to vote for the far right. So the far right only achieved some parliamentary seats because of those swing votes. And now that she's out of jail and more options exist, I would expect the far right generally to wither. But there is a problem, and there are also perennial suspicions, even by Ukrainian nationalists, that the more extreme elements and the armed elements of the far right are some people think that they're agents being paid off by Russia.
We're going to have to wrap it up, but I understand that you're going back. You and Olga, not together, but you'll be there this summer too?
I will.
Yeah.
I will.
Why?
That's my area of academic research. I'm interested in how authority and legitimacy gets formed, and I'm an anthropologist, and out of solidarity with the people that I work with, I'll be there.
Monica Eppinger, thank you so much for being with us. If we don't see you before then, have a very, very safe trip. Thank you for being with us. And Olga Cheech, thank you also for being with us. I hope you're listening. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with actor and Missouri native Ed Asner. You may recall his portrayal of Lou Grant on the old Mary Tyler Moore Show, and more recently as the voice of Carl Fredrickson in Pixar's 2009 film, Up. He's coming to St. Louis this month to perform as FDR. And what if St. Louis's population were 500,000? We'll talk about what it would take and what would happen if it were. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.